Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You know, for this holiday season, we're taking stock of the economy in your life and your neighborhood with an online map and story project called Rut or Recovery. It's on our politics website. It's a freecountry.org. We know the recovery has been uneven, obviously, and we're asking you to tell us where there is good news and where there is not. See our Rut or Recovery map and contribute a story from your life or what you observe around you. Go to our politics website. It's a freecountry.org and help document our holiday season Rut or Recovery today. Now, coming up in about 15 minutes, we will, right in our listening area, there are people living in tiny little 400 square foot studio apartments in Chelsea, and there are people going hunting. It's an amazing area that we live in. And we'll talk about the New Jersey bear hunt happening so close in a great metropolitan area, the controversial New Jersey bear hunt underway this week, and even bring some Sarah Palin into that conversation. People say she shot the caribou the wrong way on her TV show. How about that? So we'll talk about hunting coming up in a little bit. But if a company cheats you out of $30, you're probably not going to go to court over it, nor will a lawyer take your case. But if a company cheats a million people out of $30, the customers can band together and file a class action lawsuit against the company. That's the idea of class actions. But what if a company found a way to prevent customers from banding together to form a class? There are two cases before the Supreme Court right now about just that. AT&T wrote a provision into the fine print of their cell phone contracts that effectively prevents customers from forming a class. And just this week, the Supreme Court agreed to take up a gender discrimination case against Walmart. The court will rule on whether the female staffers there make up a class or if they have to sue the company individually. Both cases will have major effects on the future of class action lawsuits. So joining me now to explain these two cases and what the stakes are, and also to touch on some of the WikiLeaks legal questions, is Adam Liptak, who covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Hey, Adam, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Sure.
And just to touch briefly on WikiLeaks and follow up on our last guests, since you're surely familiar with the landmark Supreme Court ruling that the New York Times and other papers could publish the Pentagon Papers leaked by Daniel Ellsberg in the Vietnam War era, do you want to comment on the legal grounds of a potential investigation into the legality of the New York Times publishing the WikiLeaks leaks, as Senator Lieberman has called for?
It seems to me to be grandstanding. The Pentagon Papers and other Supreme Court cases and the conventional understanding of the First Amendment is that newspapers have a First Amendment right through ordinary reporting to find truthful, newsworthy information and to publish it without fear of prior restraint or subsequent punishment. The Pentagon Papers case doesn't get you all the way there. It only talks about prior restraints, and some of the justices, including justices who voted for us, said that maybe subsequent criminal prosecution under the Espionage Act was possible. But I think the proper understanding of the First Amendment is that the way our democracy should run is that the press should be able to find stuff out. It's the government's job to keep its secrets. If the government fails to keep its secrets, it can prosecute the leaker. But ordinary reporting that results in information as important to understanding the government's work as what we published from WikiLeaks is surely protected by the First Amendment.
And how about WikiLeaks itself? It's not a traditional newspaper, but it fulfills some of the same functions as journalism in that it receives the leaks from the actual leakers inside the government and then makes them public. Does that protect them in an almost blanket way under the freedom of speech and the First Amendment?
We don't know everything about how they got a hold of the information, but assuming all they did was passively receive information from somebody who did violate a duty and somebody who may well be criminally liable for that. But if all they did functionally was what the press does, I don't see why they shouldn't get the protections the press does.
All right, let's talk about class action suits. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear that Walmart case, Walmart's appeal in this case, and the gender discrimination case. Explain the difference explain the case. Why? What will the justices be ruling on with respect to whether female staffers there can form a class in alleging sex discrimination?
Well, you start started by talking a second ago about the cell phone case, and that's a nice contrast between that case and the in some ways harder Walmart case. In the cell phone case, the allegation is that AT&T ripped off people in exactly the same way for $30 a piece, and nobody's going to sue over $30, but a million people might band together and sue over $30, and it might make sense because exactly the same thing happened to them. The court is basically deciding whether that particular thing was lawful or not. Walmart is a harder case. It involves between, depending on who's counting, a half a million or 1.5 million women who say that they were all discriminated against on the basis of their gender in pay and promotion decisions at Walmart. But they worked in a lot of different stores under a lot of different managers in a lot of different jobs. And Walmart's argument is that that's not like the cell phone contract where exactly the same thing happened to everybody, that these cases are different enough, not common enough, that class action treatment is inappropriate and unfair to Walmart, which says it might have, you know, defenses woman by woman about what happened to her. Maybe she was a bad worker rather than the subject of sex discrimination. So I think the court will be rather more skeptical of the Walmart case. The cell phone case was already argued, and there you got the sense that the justices were perhaps leaning in the direction of allowing class action treatment in that case.
Now, the court, considering arguments on the AT&T case, the $30 each, they tried to form a class, but something in the fine print says they can't form a class. Explain that one.
Right. Yeah, so what AT&T did, and you've seen this in your cell phone contract or your car rental contract, is they put in the fine print two things. One, that you have to arbitrate your claim. You have to go to an informal dispute resolution mechanism. You're not allowed to go to court. And the Supreme Court has generally been sympathetic to those kinds of claims. AT&T then also says, and by the way, you can't band together for class treatment, whether in arbitration, that informal setting, or in court. And so the question in the Supreme Court was, can you sort of leverage this arbitration provision, which the Supreme Court generally upholds, into something that also prohibits class treatment in any setting? And the California courts had said, no, that's unconscionable. That we're just not going to allow companies to say you can't band together in whatever setting. And my sense of the Supreme Court argument was that the justices who are generally pro-arbitration, who are generally skeptical of class action, nonetheless were disinclined to overrule a state court finding that this is unconscionable, that the additional state rights element in the mix might be enough to tip the court in the direction of not allowing that kind of fine print clause.
What would be the ramifications if the Supreme Court does fine for AT&T? What would it mean for class action suits, you know, nationwide in all kinds of situations, if companies see they can skirt the threat of class action by manipulating the fine print?
If it goes the other way, it would seem that in any one of these fine print contracts, lawyers call them contracts of adhesion because they're not really negotiated contracts. They're take it or leave it contracts. It would seem to mean that companies in all kinds of settings could get out of class action. So a ruling in that direction would be very, very important.
Let's take a phone call. Rona in Nassau, an attorney. You're on WNYC. Hi, Rona. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm not calling as an attorney. I'm calling as a citizen.
Okay.
Class actions were really designed to help poor people who haven't got a chance if they've got a complaint that's very painful or harmful to them, but it's minor. Like you buy a new refrigerator, and after you've had it 3 days, it doesn't work because the motor breaks. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You call up the GE, I don't want to mention a name. You call anybody, and they don't come. And here you are with this brand new refrigerator, and it's not working. Then you find out that your neighbor down the block had the same problem, and that this product is a defective product. You don't have any power to go against them. It's not worth it to you. If the refrigerator costs $500, you're going to spend much more than that in legal fees, and so you have to drop it. You have to give up. The class action was designed to help people like that. If you look at class action suits, you see what they're designed about. Cars that don't function properly, that you don't want to sue whatever it is, mm-hmm. because you had a wheel fall off and you had an accident for $1,000.
Right.
It'll cost you more than that for your attorney.
That's a good explanation, Rona. Thank you. And just to name a few big cases to jog people's memories about class action suits, the 1998 $206 billion settlement with the six big tobacco companies. ExxonMobil settled for $500 million in a case related to the Valdez oil spill. WorldCom settled with investors for over $6 billion. Enron settled with investors for over $7 billion. The Aaron Brockovich case against PG&E. So these are big things that, Adam, not only have, you know, $30 worth of consequences for a lot of for a lot of citizens, but have got big social consequences when you look at all those things on that list.
Yeah, now there is a little bit of a counterargument too, because you and I have probably been members of class actions that we don't even know about,
right,
where the lawyers were paid handsomely and we were maybe entitled to a coupon or something. There are a lot of cross currents and a lot of dynamics about to what extent are they valuable. They very often are. And to what extent do they just give lawyers enormous settlement leverage over a company that, fearful of a remote chance of a catastrophic judgment, is going to settle? And not infrequently, much of the money goes to the lawyers and not the people whom they represent.
Yeah. I mean, we got a notification of one in the mail recently against a cell phone company who we had a contract with. And my wife just happened to notice that it would have been easy enough to overlook, you know, so we filled out the paperwork and sent mm-hmm. it back, and maybe we'll get a few bucks. I don't know.
Right.
But it's not going to change our lives. But some lead plaintiffs are going to get or I should say some attorneys are going to get a lot of the money. Do you think that the whistleblowers should get more of the payout in a class action suit, even though they may just be, you know, one or two of the people involved?
Well, that's been a very controversial question. In this Walmart case, there are six class representatives, six women who represent this 500,000 or 1.5 million women. And the courts have been divided over whether they can get extra for going through the pain and heartache and depositions and all the litigation, or whether they should only get what everybody else gets. And that's a hard question. The idea of class actions would probably go in the direction of everyone's a member of the class, and the fact that you happen to be the named representative doesn't make a difference. But if that's the case, it's going to be very hard to recruit people to do all the work, as it were.
Well, we're just about out of time. Any other cases pending right now that we should know about before the Supreme Court, not getting a lot of publicity yet?
Well, the cases you've probably heard about, which are the best cases to my mind, are the First Amendment cases. One about protests at military funerals, the other about violent video games and whether their sale to minor can be banned. Those are both real interesting cases.
Adam Liptak, you know many things, but do you know that you... Do you know what you're giving this holiday season? We've been asking a guest today to contribute an idea to our 2010 Brian Lehrer Show guest gift guide. It's called The Guest List. And by the way, listeners, it's up now. So if you want to look at our guest's gift list, you can see it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times, has agreed to contribute a gift item. So what are you giving, or what have you already given this year?
I like to go with an old technology, the hardcover book. And a book that I quite liked this last year was the punk rock poet Patti Smith's memoir called Just Kids, about her early years in New York City, which really evokes the 70s in New York City and starting out as a young artist. And it's just a lovely book.
Adam Liptak, that sounds great. And thanks a lot for coming on. We appreciate it a lot.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, from caribou hunting in Alaska by you-know-who to bear hunting in New Jersey. Stay with us.